I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments, great pyramids, and superstructures were lauded, listed, and visited as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week, Deadly Sins, and Snow White's Dwarves, there were always seven of them. Later lists of Magnificent Sevens have included more recent man-made structures, such as Machu Picchu and the Taj Mahal, engineering wonders, or awe-inspiring phenomena of the natural world, such as the Grand Canyon or the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is the comedian and actor Jack Carroll, who I think by some way is the youngest guest to have joined me on this podcast. Jack was born in 1998, and he shot to fame when he appeared on Britain's Got Talent as a very confident 14-year-old, making fun of Simon Cowell and the other judges, and light of his own position performing stand-up comedy sitting in his wheelchair. Jack made it all the way to the final, being pipped for first place by a Hungarian shadow puppet group. So we don't expect anything to do with Hungary or puppetry to feature on his list of wonders today. In addition to BGT, Jack has acted in a variety of TV programmes and appeared on Live at the Apollo, Sunday Night at London Palladium, and elsewhere. So I'll start by asking you, Jack, how did you get into comedy so early in life, to the extent you could go on to a national competition?
Well, it's an interesting kind of origin story, really, I suppose. Well, it is to me anyway. The listeners may disagree, but I first performed stand up comedy at my mum and dad's silver wedding anniversary party, and I kind of badgered them for weeks to let me get up and do a few jokes that I'd written, and. You know, it's kind of you can't rely on an 11-year-old to be any good. So I think they're a little bit hesitant. And my dad had he'd done this big speech about how wonderful the marriage had been and all this. And I got up and followed that by saying that was a load of rubbish. They're actually going through divorce proceedings at the moment. And luckily people laughed and some of the family still talk to us. So
yeah, but it's a big step from appearing in front of friends and family presumably a friendly audience to being on television and doing it in front of millions.
Yes, so that video got uploaded to YouTube, and the kind of right people saw that, from there on, I won a Pride of Britain award, and then the Britain's Got Talent people saw me on that and said, "Would you come and audition for the show?" I kind of think that's the good thing about doing it at the age that I did, though, because you kind of, I think, less aware of the variables and the things that could possibly go wrong performing in front of a TV audience and that kind of thing. So it's good that I started when I did, in a way.
Well, yeah, football commentators sometimes say of a young player, not quite as young as that, but, you know, as a 17-year-old or 18-year-old, they play without fear. But I'm sure there are fears and worries that a young person has. There may be different ones from an older person, but they're still there. But you evidently don't suffer from nerves in talking or trying to make people laugh.
No, I don't think so. And I think that that comes through repetition, because if I've had a couple of if I've had a month off doing it or whatever, you're back at square one. But I think that reinforcement that you get through repetition is really helpful in that regard.
No, I mentioned you're in a wheelchair because it's cerebral palsy that you have. So that's that's from birth.
Indeed, it is. Yes, from birth. I was born premature, so the kind of oxygen to my brain kind of meant that, and I kind of had a bit of a bleed on the brain as well. So that meant that I was getting dodgy signals from my brain to my legs. So it kind of made balance and things a little bit tricky. But yes, I've had it since birth.
So I mean, at any rate, I mean, it's a small advantage, but I suppose on something like Britain's Got Talent, it made you stand out from the crowd, you know, in terms of
stand out performing. Pun intended there or not?
I didn't want to apologise in advance. Just let it stand up comedy, standing out the crowd, but you weren't able to stand up. You had to sit in a chair.
No, I think it does make comedy. People don't really like hearing it, but I think it does make doing comedy slightly easier because at least you've got something to talk about. You know, if if ever I'm having a slow day of kind of coming up with ideas, I know, again, pun slightly intended, I know I've got the cerebral palsy to fall back on. If things are working slowly, I know I can always talk about disability. Yeah. From that perspective and kind of a way in, it has been helpful. I've got to say that. I mean, it's not the most fashionable. Yeah. Statement, but it has been very helpful to my career. So,
well, I wouldn't necessarily put it that way, but all in the modern way of stand up comedy, everybody eventually talks about their family background or the race they come from, maybe sex, maybe gender, and whatever else that is relevant to them becomes usually the focus of at least some of their comedy. Well, let's get on with the wonders that you have selected. You've come up with seven of them. So the first one is Elland Road. So explain why that is a wonder to you.
Yeah, so I'm a big Leeds United fan. Leeds United play their home games at Elland Road. And the reason why I put the stadium in rather than the football team is because I think that kind of as good as watching it on television is, I don't think anything can replace the immediacy and the atmosphere that you get from going to watch a game live. And I think that a lot of you know, I've had a lot of happy memories in that place, and I think that's why for me, for my own kind of personal world, that is a wonder of the world for me.
Well, I don't want to be controversial from the beginning, but you must have had some unhappy memories as well.
Two
or three years at Leeds have been something of a revival, but there's been some bleak years corresponding to your lifetime. I have a longer memories of Leeds going back, long way. I noticed the stadium has got stands named after Norman Hunter, no uncompromising defender. Don Revie, an uncompromising manager. Jack Bremner. Yeah, it's a tough club. Most of the time.
Yeah, I met Norman Hunter a few times, and I didn't need a wheelchair until he tried to tackle me. I told him that joke and he did laugh, luckily. So, you say that, I think that is kind of the pretty much all my time following Leeds has been in the lower divisions. So to see us in the Premiership now, it's kind of like that paradise syndrome thing. Though now we've got what we wanted, part of me is kind of harking back to Milton Keynes on a rainy Tuesday night, really, because I think that's the stuff I grew up on.
Sure, but you've got a little way to go to get back to where Leeds was once upon a time. Let's say you'd have to now be challenging for the Premier League, which is pretty hard, and then Europe as well, which Leeds was at that level before they went into a huge decline. I'm sorry to damage your chips.
This early on.
Sorry, I'm a bit bitter because I'm much older than you. And my first memory of Leeds really is Leeds beating Arsenal, who I support, in the League Cup final in 1968. A horrible game. Not just the result.
Yes.
And it was played horribly and won horribly by Leeds. You've had better moments and I've had better moments since then.
Yes, yeah. You'll know this from moving from one stadium to the next. Like the it's hard to recreate that atmosphere, I think.
But there's no plan to move from Elland Road, is there? It's still performing well enough to carry on at the Premier League level.
Just about, and we had it blessed by a priest a few years ago to try and ward off any bad luck. So hopefully that's why that might be why we're in the Premiership now.
Yes. Well, that sounds like cheating to me, getting God on your side. But I think players do that quite often, don't they? They cross themselves, or they look to the heavens, or they bow down to Mecca, whichever is their preference.
Yeah.
But surely God has to be a neutral sort of VAR observer of the game rather than one player or one team.
I think that's, it depends if he's got a bet on that week, I suppose.
I don't think God needs to have a bet on.
Well, he's
omnipotent, all-seeing, all-knowing. He can win in any race. So your next wonder you have is The Sopranos, which I suppose you mean by that, I don't have any further, is the television series hailed by some people as the best TV programme of all time. But it came and went before your time, did it not?
It did indeed, yes. Well, I was alive during it, but certainly not old enough to watch it. I picked The Sopranos because I think, like, I've rewatched it around about four times now, I think, and I pick up new
all the way through.
Yeah, and I pick up. I try to do it once a year, and I pick up kind of new kind of layers of meaning and things like that every single time. And I don't think there are a lot of things, especially on television, with that kind of value that you can kind of squeeze out of it over and over again.
It was one of the early ones, which we now talk of as like a box set that people, I mean, now you don't have to get the box, but that people do watch these series, either all in a go in a binge watch when it first comes out, or as you've done, going back to it later. So The Wire, The Sopranos, all those kind of big programs, 24.
Yeah.
This is probably a different way of watching television programmes that's come along in the last few years. So it is possible for somebody of your age to be a fan, as you might have, a previous generation might have been a fan of an old film.
Yeah, and I think that is the thing that it still holds up. I think a couple of those things kind of, you can tell they're of the time. But I think the thing with The Sopranos is, if you kind of take the glitzy mafia element out of it, that the human drama of it, and the kind, you can read it at a lot of different levels, I think, is the thing I enjoy about it. That there's a lot there depending on what level you want to pitch it at as a viewer. That's what makes it so rewarding, I think, that it's kind of a little bit about everything.
Well, but it is about gangsters and the mafia, and it's not alone in that regard. It seems endlessly interesting, whether it's films, The Godfather, The Goodfellas, there's dozens of them, you know, The Traitor, The Irishman, also American filmmakers and television makers, and by extension the rest of the world, seems endlessly fascinated with these ghastly people and their loyalty to family but commitment to mayhem and murder and theft. Is that what attracts you to this program as well? Are you a secret gangster underneath it all?
I mean, I kind of an idealized version without the murder would be what I'd be striving for. I suppose it's that quintessential American story of the American dream, isn't it? It's like someone trying to come over and make something of themselves, and I think that is, and then ultimately failing, I think, is like you say, that repeats and repeats.
So I've mentioned you're obviously a comedian, but also an actor. So would you, are there parts or dramas that you would like to be in as a some sort of gangster or, I don't know, investigator, victim? You know, something you'd like to be in, maybe initially a British kind of one? Or
I think I'd probably be a more plausible victim than anything else.
No, I was just imagining you as some sort of evil mastermind. Maybe a bit too young for that yet, but you could be stroking a cat and plotting the downfall of some enemy. Or
yeah, other. I mean, I do that in my daily life, so it wouldn't be much of a stretch to do that on screen. I was just going to say, for the benefit of the listener, I am growing a little moustache at the moment, so I am slightly resembling Fredo Corleone in The Godfather. So who knows?
Well, it could be. I recently interviewed Stephen Van Zandt, who's a guitarist. But he got a part in The Sopranos. So just by giving out an award at a Hall of Fame, the Rock Hall of Fame, he just happened to do that rather well. And he got a part in The Sopranos as a result of that. So anything could happen in your case as well, yeah.
Indeed. And, you know, if the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are watching, they don't come, many don't come as rock and roll as me. So yeah, that could be in the future.
So does that justify everything that you do?
Excuse me, let me tell you something. When America opened the floodgates and let all us Italians in, what do you think they were doing it for? Because they were trying to save us from poverty? No, they did it because they needed us. They needed us to build their cities and dig their subways and to make them richer. The Carnegies and the Rockefellers, they needed worker bees, and there we were. But some of us didn't want to swarm around their hive and lose who we were. We wanted to stay Italian and preserve the things that meant something to us, honor and family and loyalty. And some of us wanted a piece of the action.
Okay. All right. So that was your second wonder of the world. And then we go off in a completely different direction, I think. Now, your third wonder is a decent cup of coffee.
Yeah, I am.
That carries the implication that there are cups of coffee that you've had that are not decent. And is this a quest that you've never got to the end of? You've never got a decent cup of coffee? Or are there identifiable ones that you can speak well about?
No, there certainly are. There's good coffee and bad coffee, and I think good coffee, well, decent coffee, as I've written, is it's something that you know fuels me through the day, and I think it's kind of you know, it's a kind of early solace within the day that you can enjoy the taste, and then there are other cups of coffee that you might get on trains or whatever that tastes like unleaded diesel. So they don't bring quite the same level of enjoyment.
So are you a meticulous maker of coffee yourself? Are you somebody who really concentrates? Have you got one of those huge machines at home that you grind up your own beans?
Yes. Yeah, I've got a bean to cup machine. I'm basically working on getting a similar infrastructure to Starbucks, but with more taxation involved. But yeah, I've got a bean to cup machine, so I can try all kind of different varieties of coffee from around the globe, and I think that's nice because I don't know whether my very pale skin gives it away, but I don't travel to sunny climates all that much. So experiencing that through the coffee and the kind of different tastes you get from different nations and continents is really interesting to me.
So you're a connoisseur of the coffee bean. And is it the way of making it that's also important? The exact temperature of the water, the strength, the additions. What is it that
I leave that to the professionals and people less lazy than me. I just press a button and the machine does the work for me. I did realise recently that when I tell people I bought a coffee machine, they go, "Oh, that's fantastic." But if I told them I bought a machine that gives me anxiety and makes me shit myself, then that would be slightly. But that is essentially what I've done.
Well, I can only say that when I was growing up, this what we called coffee at home was something made out of a powder that came in a great big tin and was mixed up with hot water and milk, and it didn't really taste like coffee at all. But that's all we knew. And then coffee granules came in, and that was a bit better. And only in later life have I experienced more regularly the joy of proper coffee.
Yeah.
But I always find the idea of having a cup of coffee is better than the actual coffee itself. After the first smell of it and the sip of it, I've had enough. But I don't want to, get in the way of your and desires.
Yeah, well, maybe you just haven't found the right coffee yet. You have to come over for a cup of coffee, and we'll I'll take you through some different varieties.
Well, I will do. Do you still live in Yorkshire or Leeds or
I'm nearby there. I'm still in Yorkshire. Yeah, still in West Yorkshire. If you're ever passing through this way, I'll get the machine temperature turned right up.
Well, I look forward to it. I suppose Yorkshire, strange enough, is famous for its tea.
It is.
They actually grow in the county.
I mean, we offer that as well at the cafe that I've now started in my kitchen.
Well, tea is another thing. It's quite hard to get right for the person ordering it. I only really like tea that I make myself, because everybody else, certainly you're mentioning going on trains and cafes and things, they often get it wrong. And anywhere abroad, it's just hopeless. They seem incapable of the thing. They bring a tea bag in a saucer with a cup of cooling water next to it and expect you to dunk that into the cup.
Yeah.
Thinking that's going to make a good cup of tea. Anyway, I'm straying off into my taste and into tea rather than the coffee. So a decent cup of coffee. You have managed to, you can make it yourself, and you have managed to find it sometimes. Not always, yeah.
The golden rules for buying coffee. And the first one, you probably know. Buy fresh. But what does fresh mean? Now, coffee after roasting declines in a pretty steady way over time. It loses its aromatics, they kind of float off into the atmosphere and escape. And you also develop some unpleasant flavours. Things go stale and they begin to oxidise.
All right, so that's a decent cup of coffee. The next thing, your next of your wonders, is comedy writing. So I can see why comedy might be in your list of wonders. But for most people, even very successful comedians or writers, find the actual process of writing quite hard work. So is it the process of writing that you like, or do you appreciate other people's writing?
I enjoy the process myself. It's my favourite thing that I do, is the actual kind of writing of the comedies. Of all the things that I do, that's my favourite. And I think it's that kind of that idea of being able to concisely get a point across and also make someone laugh that I find pretty. Yeah. When someone does it to me, I find that amazing. And when I'm, hopefully the few times I've been able to do it to other people, that's equally thrilling for me.
Yeah. Well, you've done it plenty of occasions, but is it the moment that you're, I don't know how you work, do you sit at a word, a computer terminal and think of a joke and write it down and you say, that's perfect, I can see I've got that to work? Or is it when you first do it to an audience and then that confirms that it really does work because it makes other people laugh, not just yourself?
Yeah.
When is the magic moment for you in comedy writing?
I mean, unfortunately, me and the audience don't always agree on what's funny. But I prefer my opinion to theirs. I think it is that moment, whether you're a computer keyboard or writing in a notebook, where you go, I've got a good one there. And that's the kind of excavation that you're doing, where you're trying to what is the thing, and then you stumble upon the thing. And I think it's that moment of stumbling upon it where that's the real satisfying, that's the stuff for me.
In the main, how do you do it when you're doing comedy writing? Are you doing it. So, oh, I've got something to do at a performance on television or my an event for my parents. I've got to write something 5 minutes for that, 10 minutes for that. Mm. Or are you just constantly adding to the pot of jokes that you've thought of from which you'll draw for and on any particular occasion?
I think with stand-up, it comes in bursts and I'll be really productive for a couple of weeks and then there'll be a kind of dry period for a while after and then I'll pick it back up again. But I think it's important to keep those to keep things oiled and try and keep my hand in as much as I can.
And do you or would you ever write for other people or other things, either for another comedian or let's say a sitcom or a film or a movie, write a substantial or novel? I don't know, any form of comedy.
Yeah.
Since you've got comedy writing there, that you might want to expand the writing side of it.
So I wrote a sitcom co-wrote a sitcom over the lockdown, which hopefully we're filming in the summer, so that's very exciting.
Can you tell me what it's called, or is that dangerous to reveal too much?
Well, it is. I think it is. It's probably dangerous to reveal, but you know, we're on the correct platform for that. If this gets picked up, then we've made an exclusive, haven't we? It's called Mobility. So that'll be hopefully out sometime in the next little while.
Are you going to be in it or are you writing it for other people to perform?
No, I'm going to be in it as well. So that'll be good. I couldn't let other people have that.
quite right.
I love all kinds of, that's what, again, why I put comedy writing down. Like I'm really into it in all its forms. Hopefully that's certainly something that I'd like to carry on with.
And you mentioned you've written it with somebody else. That's a slightly different process if there's two of you writing it rather than sitting with a notebook or jotting something down a notebook. Do you find that process helpful or creative or traumatizing to have to convince somebody else that something's funny even before you get it to an audience?
I think coming from a stand-up background, like, that's a real luxury, being able to collaborate. I really enjoy that spirit of collaboration, and I think most of the time things you do with other people are better than the sum of its parts, really. And I think stand-up comedies can be very lonely in that it's just you and you're your only bellwether, pretty much. Until you give it to an audience to shoot down. So I really have enjoyed working with other people.
Well, David Baddiel, who's done this podcast with me, one of his wonders, I'm just getting the exact wording right, the sound of a big laugh in response to a new bit of material. that's him doing stand-up, which he does. It's that the moment that he goes for, or he went for, because he knows at that point he's now got something he can do again or incorporate into his performing later. So
yes,
that's why I was asking whether it's the creative moment, or because sometimes I'm telling you this, you know this, you come up with something spontaneously as you do something, you don't know, it gets a laugh, and then you might have an extra thought, oh, and I can do that again if I can just remember it for next time.
Yeah, and they're always real gifts when they come along, I think. That's great. That's really good.
Yeah. So I should ask you, just in case, you don't have to tell me any of this if you don't want to. So you've got Mobility. Do you know who's going to be broadcasting it?
I think all being well, that'll be on the BBC iPlayer. So. All being well.
Anyway, so comedy writing, this has clearly been part of your life for ages. So if you started doing, I mean, you even said when you spoke at your parents' silver wedding celebration, you didn't say I made a speech. You said I did some stand-up comedy. I did comedy at there. So was it? What had inspired you to doing that? Is it just the way you are, naturally funny, or have you always watched or listened to other comedy, followed it in other
forms? Yeah. I've been a huge comedy fan, right, from being very young, and also through family, I was always surrounded by very funny people who knew how to make each other laugh. So that was great. And then we'll come on to it a bit later on, but I had surgery on my spine when I was 6 years old. So I was laid up in the hospital for a good few weeks, and all I did through them was watch comedy DVDs. So in terms of getting an interest, I'd always been kind of interested in writing and stories and that side of things at school. So they kind of coalesced and I thought that's really interesting to me. I probably shouldn't have been getting the jokes I was getting at 6 and 7 years old, but somehow I managed it.
You knew from the rhythm they must be funny, or you're getting the innuendo. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Indeed. Well, yeah.
Since you've mentioned it, why don't we go on to another of your wonders then, which you've put it down as selective dorsal rhizotomy. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes.
So this is the operation you're talking about.
Yeah. So it was a 6-hour operation that I had, where they took my spine out and kind of cut the nerves away that were sending signals to my feet that were kind of to do with the cerebral palsy, and that's the I don't know if you can tell, but that's the non-medical explanation. I'm not a doctor. Okay.
No, but you are the patient, and did you say you had this at 6 years old?
Mm, yeah.
So how much did you understand when your parents or the doctors or whoever said, well, there's this big operation for you to have, and this will help with the way you operate with your feet and your legs and so forth. Were you able to understand what was going on, or was this is just what life is like, because that's just all you knew, that there were going to be things like this? Was it a shock to the system, I suppose, I'm asking, even the news that you're going to have a big operation?
Yeah, I suppose it is just that thing of you get on with it at that age, don't you? Because you don't know anything different. So I did just get on with it. Although that's not to say I handled with the maturity of a 6-year old, because apparently when I came round, dosed up with morphine and anaesthetic, I demanded to see the head surgeon. So I think the quote my mum told me at the time, the quote was, so I could use his head as a basketball. I was furious that it'd been done to me, but I was certainly a funny little kid.
Yeah, well, you sound as though you were, but this is quite a thing to go through. But did it have an immediate effect? Did they say, oh, well, the operation's a big success, or did you have to spend months in recovery before you could even make an assessment of what it had done?
Yeah, so there was about a month, I would say, month, 6 weeks in recovery, if I remember correctly. And then because I couldn't walk unaided before this operation. So that's what the kind of ideal outcome was, that I'd be able to walk unaided. And so from then on, I had to train up the sensory kind of thing of getting my balance and all that kind of thing. So that was the next job then, and unfortunately it did work, and that's a great wonder for me, is that I couldn't walk, and because of the kind of wonder of the surgery, I'm now able to.
Yeah. So, it obviously sounds like a great wonder, but having come through that period when he wanted to use the surgeon's head as a basketball in response to what he was putting you through, have you been able to reassess that? And evidently you have, but were you able to talk to him yourself in later years and say, well, thank you very much, and what an extraordinary thing to do an operation like that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I was probably being a bit hasty, given how it has actually turned out. I haven't had any contact with the surgeon for a long time now. But I would love to reach out and have a chat. I think that's something that I should get on with. So thank you for the reminder.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he or her may have seen you on the television being a success and a wow in Britain's Got Talent and elsewhere. And there might be some quiet satisfaction that, perhaps without me and my team's skill, this wouldn't have been possible. I may not be able to write jokes as a surgeon, but I can get a comedian going. So they might be very pleased.
Either that, or he said that kid threatened to cut my head off when he was 6 years old. I don't want to see him again. That could be the other outcome.
He was probably voting for the Hungarian shadow puppets as a result. That's what cost you the success.
That was the deciding vote. That would be like a real Shakespearean ending to the whole thing. That's amazing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, so now another of your wonders. Again, this isn't one that sort of leaps out. It's an obvious one for you to choose at all. The interviews of Leonard Cohen.
Yes.
So why Leonard Cohen, and why his interviews rather than his songs, his performances, his poetry, his other bits of writing? As somebody who interviews people a lot, I'm pleased to see that interviews, in this case, outrank all the other achievements. But what is it about Leonard Cohen, and what is it about his interviews?
So I'm obviously a big fan of Leonard Cohen's songs and poetry and all that kind of thing. But I think that's one of the great things about YouTube, is that there is a huge archive of like long form interviews of your favourite cultural figures available at the touch of a button. And I remember I went to see Will Self the other year, and he said something interesting about YouTube. He was like, he said we're kind of closer to the 60s than people in the 60s were, if you want to be, because you can analyze it frame by frame on YouTube. Right. And I think I've watched quite a good few of Leonard Cohen's long form interviews, and it's kind of charming, wise old man figure that I think with some kind of real nuggets of wisdom in there, and a good few laughs, and that's what I've enjoyed about them.
Yes, but you're right. There's a strange phenomenon. This is because it's not just interviews, but certainly interviews done 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago were largely ephemeral. They were there for that programme, for that moment, and nobody watched them repeatedly. Same with, children's cartoon shows and films and everything that people didn't have an opportunity to watch and rewatch. But as you're saying, Will Self was saying, that this is this is now something that it's got a different status in the world, different category.
Yeah,
people can use them to study endlessly.
Yes. And I think that is one of the that's where I put it down, because I think that it kind of
obviously Leonard Cohen, there are more interviews than, say, Bob Dylan doesn't do very many interviews, so you'd only have about one or two that you could study. With Leonard Cohen, was happier to chat about things in general and his work as well. So is that what's makes his interviews more interesting than some others?
Yeah, I think it is that thing of there's a lot of them out there as well, so you build up a little bit more, well, as much as you can from a 5-minute interview. You build up a little bit more of a picture of the artist, and he does. I think that's an interesting point, like to use Bob Dylan as a contemporary. I think Leonard Cohen does seem a little bit more generous with his opinions and his kind of letting you into his whole thing than maybe a Bob Dylan does, who's quite guarded and quite. I watched the Scorsese Rolling from the Netflix documentary about Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And it kind of struck me that the difference between him and Leonard Cohen is that Leonard Cohen seems a lot more kind of centered in the world than Bob Dylan, who seems a little bit more, I don't know, like haunted by the visions or something. Like there's something that he can't quite get across. Whereas I think one of the great things is that he's concise and he delivers things with humour, but there's also a good amount of weight behind what he says as well.
Yes. Perhaps he's not as, and I don't mean this as a criticism at all, but he certainly initially wasn't anything like as confident in his own ability as a singer and a songwriter. He had to be almost forced into doing it. I think Judy Collins almost made him start performing, and he didn't even want to do it. So, whereas Bob Dylan, had early success and was early capable of writing lots and lots of songs with mysterious meanings to them that he thought it better to keep to himself sometimes. But I suppose I asked these about the Sopranos as well. These are things from not the ancient past, but they are a decade or two ago that you're interested in. Is that a function of your character? Do you think there are aspects of life? You're not just somebody living in the latest trend. You're able to pick up and look at things from, let's say before you were born or around about the time you were born.
Yeah, I think probably because I'm basically an old man at heart, I would imagine. There's something I don't know why that is, but there's something a lot of my interests are like that. That's not to say that all of them are, obviously, but I think I don't know why that is, and maybe there's a listener out there with the correct qualifications to be able to psychoanalyze that, but I'm not going
to
do it.
Well, this is our main function here, just to make a podcast, send it out, and hope that somebody will give you some advice. But there's nothing to be worried about. It's a sort of frantic thing to try and keep up with what's going on sometimes. That means you miss out. If you're interested in reading novels, for example, you can read this year's novel, or you can read Charles Dickens. Nobody thinks it's odd if you're a fan of Dickens or Hardy or Tolstoy or something.
And I think that's probably that's a stamp of quality, right? The fact that it's lasted for a long time is a mark of quality.
Well, I don't know. You may seem so to yourself, but you must admit that for other people looking at you, Leonard Cohen, the poet, the novelist, the man who lives in a White House on the island of Hedra, scion of a Jewish family from Montreal, pop singer and writer of pop songs, all these things, they may certainly add up to Leonard Cohen, but they do look rather complex at first.
Well, I think that, you know, the borders have faded between a lot of endeavors, and people are no longer, I think, capable of those kind of poses, like the poet, you know, on the mountain with the cape, and or the singer, you know, sort of catering to the masses. All those kinds of expression, I think, are completely meaningless. They don't mean anything to me. It's just a matter of what your hand falls on. And if you can make what your hand falls on sing, then you can just do it. I mean, if someone offered me a building to design now, I'd take it up. If someone offered me a small country to govern, I'd take it. You know, anything going, I'd like to try.
So we're now on to your seventh and last wonder. Jack, what is that?
It is the concept of flow state.
Right. So this is would I call this being in the zone? Is that the sort of thing that we're talking about, or is it
Indeed.
More complicated than that?
Yeah. No. That at a basic level, that is the kind of point to it. So I read a book over the first lockdown called Flow by a psychologist called hopefully I don't butcher the pronunciation too much, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, it's called Flow, and it's all about this concept of flow states, which I really kind of responded to. And the more I look at things I enjoy in my life, the more I see that they follow this kind of pattern and have this kind of flow architecture to them.
Yeah. So just let me try and get my head around this as well. I've tried to understand this in the past, but it sounds like you're on top of it. So it's is it a combination of being able to concentrate on things, to find a sweet spot for what you're doing? It could be what a sportsman does. It could be what a writer does. It could be what anybody does, but they get into a special state of mind where everything clicks together. Well, I mean, I'm probably oversimplifying it, but is that what we're talking about?
That is it, and I think it's the way he describes it is like the conference between enjoyment and meaning, where it's you forget about all your problems, but you emerge out of the state with a reinforced sense of self, and it's that kind of thing of you're so involved in doing something that you forget about your own stuff, but also it reinforces and improves your experience.
So can you get into that? Do you feel you're in that state when you're on stage performing or on television performing? Come to that when it you. The show's going well, the first joke's gone well, and you go into a flow state. Would that apply there, would you say?
I think when it's going really well, you do, but there's also times kind of on the negative side of that where I'll be doing a routine, and obviously I've done the routine so much that I'll be thinking about what I'm going to have for my dinner when I get home. So I'm saying the words, but I don't have much connect. Yeah. So there is that. And I think the performance aspect of things, it's harder to get into that state because obviously you've got a lot more to manage, and it's a little bit more difficult to be unselfconscious about that. Right. But as we were talking earlier about the comedy writing side of things, I think that's a lot easier because there's less urgency to manage there. The environment is a little bit more relaxing, and I think that helps get into the flow state.
Now, for me, I understand what you say there, but for me, I would say it can be harder to get into a flow state when you're writing because there's plenty of distractions that might be around. It could be somebody, you know, whistling for their dog outside.
Maybe,
I'll have a cup of coffee. Maybe, this isn't due in for another
couple
of days. Whereas being in a position, but I've had it in two ways in my life. One is just performing in any sort of way or concentrating in a studio. I used to be a barrister. So in court, you're just concentrating on the case. You don't think about all your other problems. And I can think in both of those performing kind of situations, I just noticed coming out of it when the court case, the court day is over, or the studio is finished, or I've come off stage.
Yes.
Oh, I've been in a flow state, I think, or something like it. But no, I'm not, because I'm now thinking, oh, I didn't cancel my dental appointment.
Yes.
Or the car's got a flat tire when I drove here. All those extra problems you just put out of your mind. So, but I don't know if I'm grasping this idea at all.
No, I'd agree with that. That sounds like a flow state. From what I've read, that sounds like a flow state to me. And would you say that in your experience that is like peak experience, that you enjoyed that so much?
Yes, I would say so. And I suppose there have been moments, limited moments in my case, where I've got into a flow state when I'm writing something. But that's generally there's an urgency to it, and I rule out everything. And if it goes well, I could say maybe that was a flow state. But it sounds like you're a bit better at that you can settle down and say, right, I've got a couple of ideas, and then I'm going to develop those and go on to something else. And a few hours later, you've written a whole new comedy routine or something.
Maybe I'm just lazier. I mean, I find it easy to relax, maybe.
So it's it's a combination of enjoyment and relaxation
and meaning, and meaning as well.
Well, look, Jack, this has been a fascinating journey through aspects of your life, anyway, through these seven wonders. And it's been a joy to talk to you. You having shared your seven wonders, I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven. The one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you've described it in this podcast. Tempted though I am to put in Elland Road, home of the mighty Leeds. I think it would be, and I'm interested in flow states and comedy writing, obviously, but I think I have to make the wonder of wonder from this podcast, selective dorsal rhizotomy, because it's such a startling operation to have to go through, thankfully successfully, and a little bit of a tip the hat to the poor old surgeon who got a hard time from 6-year-old self. But it is clearly a wonder of medicine and wonder of surgery that it's possible to do such a radical operation with such good results.
I'd agree with that for sure.
So thank you Jack. Amazing. Carroll, thank you for joining me on this podcast.
Thank you for having me, Clive.
No, well, it's been a pleasure. And if I can say to the listeners, if you enjoyed listening to My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform, site or provider you found us on. Thank you very much. And thank you, Jack Carroll.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.